Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on April 4th, 2017. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Kulasanatha Sutta, the shorter discourse on emptiness. This is the first of three talks on emptiness as the Buddha taught emptiness, to empty oneself of ignorance of Four Noble Truths. A related article is at crossrivermeditation.com. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. So this week I'll give three talks on three different suttas where the Buddha addresses emptiness. Tonight is on the Kulasanatha Sutta, the lesser discourse on emptiness. Thursday will be on the Mahasanatha Sutta, the greater discourse on emptiness, and Saturday will be on the Kakaya Yanagata Sutta. No, it's not. where the Buddha relates emptiness directly to the five clinging aggregates and dependent origination, and that's all kind of leading up to our one-day retreat on Sunday, which is not a requirement to attend if you're going to. We're going to cover a lot of it this week. Emptiness is another one of those greatly misunderstood and misapplied teachings, and I'll talk a little bit more about that when I actually read the article. But it's important to understand that the only thing the Buddha was concerned about was to develop an understanding of ourselves in relation to the world that is based on wisdom and not continued ignorance. So you remember what dependent origination states, that it's from ignorance of Four Noble Truths that all manner of confusion, delusion, and suffering arises. So when the Buddha uses the term emptiness, it's in that vein. It's not to describe some grand mystical environment. It's simply that we're empty of ignorance. And you can say that everything the Buddha taught is geared towards that, to emptying ourselves of ignorance. And it's better to see emptiness as a verb rather than a noun. In other words, we're taking, in this way it's connected to karma too, we're taking direct action to empty ourselves of our own ignorance. And you remember that karma means action. So emptiness in this light relates to the cessation of karma and the cessation of giving birth to another ignorant moment. And I'm not reading the entire introduction because much of that is what we discuss here every week. Much of the later developed Buddhist schools treat emptiness and nothingness as a mystical environment to be realized where all Dharma contradictions can be reconciled. What is often overlooked in the customary use of emptiness is that this adapted use of emptiness now becomes the repository for what has been avoided by ignoring the Four Noble Truths. And I get into this in a little bit more detail as we go along, but what I'm talking about here is the many of the later developed schools treat anatta as meaning no self, as in that there's no such thing as a self, and they treat the achievement of awakening as entering into this void of nothingness. And for all the years that I was studying other developed schools, that always kind of bothered me. Why am I chasing after something where the end result is nothingness? But I went along with it because I was associated with other people doing the same, and it seemed, okay, there must be something to this nothingness thing, to this application emptiness. But it always gnawed at me, and it wasn't until I looked at what the Buddha taught and what he meant by emptiness that it made perfect sense. And when you relate emptiness to the emptiness of ignorance, of course, that's what the Buddha's teaching. This adapted application of emptiness now provides a conceptual acceptance through avoidance that allows for continued ignorance. What that means is you don't really have to get into what the Buddha meant about not self, not no self, and you avoid this whole idea of taking all these things that you can't reconcile into nothingness and just apply them in that way. In other words, everything I can't understand is part of this emptiness. It just doesn't make sense. That's often referred to as everything in the phenomenal world is inherently absent of a permanent existence. That's true, but it doesn't relate to the Dhamma. That's just a statement of fact. It's just like saying everything is impermanent. But when we don't understand the interaction between a ignorant view of self and impermanence, that's where we get into trouble. So, of course, everything in the phenomenal world is in a constant state of change. There's no inherent state of permanence, But that's not an application of emptiness. The term fits, but it's not what the Buddha's talking about. But it's convenient to say that in the end, everything is empty and everything has its own inherent Buddha nature, and we all have Buddhahood, and that's all covered in this umbrella of emptiness. But it doesn't address what the Buddha taught. And again, he never taught any of those things, that there's any inherent Buddha nature or Buddhahood in any of us. He simply said that the views that we have are views rooted in ignorance. And he taught us a way to become empty of those views, empty of that ignorance. So I'm emphasizing that point, empty of ignorance. So this is also a subtle form of asceticism and annihilation, obviously, when you can boil all of life down to this thing that there's no such thing as anything, and we're all living in this great void. That's annihilation, and that's asceticism. And that's exactly what the Buddha denied when he developed the Eightfold Path and called that the middle way between these extreme views. And of course, developing a cosmic view of the world of emptiness is the essence of an extreme ascetic view, isn't it? I'm going to go back to that one sentence. This is also a subtle form of asceticism and annihilation, which is clearly an extreme view that is avoided by the middle way guidance of the entire Eightfold Path as the framework for Dhamma practice. This conceptual application rooted in wrong view then allows for ignorance of the three marks of existence, anicca, anatta, and dukkha. Anicca, impermanence, and anatta, the not-self characteristic, describe the ever-changing environment in which wrong views of self arise, seeking to establish a permanent self-identity. This self-establishment is both unreasonable and impossible. The result is ongoing confusion, ongoing deluded thinking, and ongoing disappointing and unsatisfactory experiences. And if you don't address that directly, you're never going to gain an understanding of the three marks of existence. This is, in a word, dukkha, the arising of which is the first noble truth. Dukkha occurs. You see, everything feeds back to that, Buddha's first teaching. For those new to Buddhism or anyone confused by modern dharmas, it is important to recognize and acknowledge these significant differences so that the purpose and foundation of any Buddhist practice is clearly understood. Whether you're practicing something else other than what the Buddha taught, you should know what you're practicing, shouldn't you? And if the end result and the purpose of your practice is to achieve this state of nothingness, that's fine. You know, go after it. It's just not what the Buddha taught. There is nothing skillful in attempting to reconcile the many contradictory forms of modern Buddhism into one hybridized individual or group Buddhist practice when a misapplication or ignorance of the Four Noble Truths is the result. Continued ignorance only continues ignorance. The modern conceptual applications of emptiness are themselves originating in ignorance of dependent origination. Often the Paticca-samuppada Vibhanga Sutta, that's the Vibhanga Sutta, the Sutta on Dependent Origination, is altered or completely ignored in order to allow for the modern concepts of interdependence, interconnectedness, and interbeing. It is this initial ignorance of dependent origination that allows for the contradictory modern applications of emptiness and the many modern contradictory Buddhist practice. This modern confusing doctrine hopes to show that all things, including all human beings, are infinitely interdependent, constantly interconnected, and can only thrive through interbeing. So you can see how that creates a constant craving even in your own Buddhist practice, that I must create something that can't possibly exist, meaning I'm part of one giant interbeing organism. There's some physical truth to that, in that the elements that make up me make up the elements of everyone. So in that sense, we're connected. But in the sense of gaining awakening, we are discrete individuals. And there's no value in creating a Dhamma practice about interconnectedness or interbeing, because while it may be true in a physical sense, in a sense of scientific physics, it has no bearing on the Dhamma. It's just the truth. It's like saying a tree grows from an acorn. An oak tree grows from an acorn. That's true. But we don't want to make a Dhamma practice about focusing on how we're part of an oak tree. It doesn't lead to anything. All things are interdependent, interconnected, and interbe, and so empty of a separate existence. Simple physics shows that there are elements common to all physical objects. The commonality of physical elements does not resolve the problem of dukkha occurring from individual craving for and clinging to impermanent views and experiences. So even if we're all interdependent and interconnected, it's on the individual level that we become confused. Resolving dukkha and physical elemental commonality have no useful relationship as far as awakening is concerned. Of course, the Buddha did not teach to see oneself in everything and to see everything as oneself. The Buddha taught that everything in the phenomenal world is discrete and carries the three marks of existence. The Buddha awakened to the profound understanding that the common human problem of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking arose from individual ignorance. Greed or craving or desire, aversion or hatred, and deluded thinking are known as three defilements common to unawakened human beings, those lacking the full maturity that is developed through gaining understanding of Four Noble Truths. All things in the phenomenal world carry the three marks of existence. For the 45 years of his teaching career, the Buddha taught consistently that the five clinging aggregates, what is perceived as a self, are all impermanent, and we've talked about that often. Yeah, any questions, just holler out, please, while I'm reading.
Can I just say what the
three marks of existence?
Yeah,
anicca, impermanence.
All right.
Anatta, the not-self-characteristic, right. And dukkha, the resulting dukkha from the misunderstanding of the interplay between anicca and anatta. I'll go back one. The five clinging aggregates, what is perceived as a self, are impermanent. What is impermanent, that is dukkha. It's unsatisfactory. Another word you could use is it's distracting. It's disappointing. And it's simply because we don't understand reality. In other words, we don't understand the interplay between individual self-referential views and the always impermanent world. In other words, these self-referential views are always seeking to establish a permanent self in this environment that is empty of all impermanence. And so when we're creating a doctrine of a permanent self, that's rooted in ignorance. Hence, empty yourself of that ignorance. Whatever is impermanent, that is dukkha, that is unsatisfactory. Whatever is dukkha, that is without atta, meaning without a self, without a permanent self. What is without a self, that is not mine, that I am not. That is not myself. And we talk about that often here too. When you find yourself caught up in anything, it's because you've attached yourself to a situation that is always fluid and you're insisting that that situation is permanent. That's a self-referential view. Let go of the view. You're seeing yourself in something where the self can't be established. The Buddha continues, thus should it be seen by perfect wisdom as it really is. Who sees by perfect wisdom as it really is? His mind, not grasping, is detached from the taints, the three defilements. He is liberated. Again, going back to the three marks of existence, going back to emptying yourself of this initial ignorance. And again, substituting the teachings on emptiness for some kind of mystical environment is grasping after a way of establishing the self in some other realm. And so that can be clearly seen in some of the schools that promote this doctrine of an inner Buddha nature. Well, what is that except trying to establish a self-identity within this thing that the Buddha said all of those views are rooted in ignorance? And by the way, the Buddha never taught anything that could in any way be related to inner Buddha nature, inner Buddhahood, or any of these other concepts that have developed. He never talked about interbeing or interconnectedness, simply because they're not useful in developing an understanding of the Dhamma. In some instances, there's truth to all of those things. But again, it's like saying an oak tree grows out of an acorn. Since that's true, I should make it part of my Dhamma practice. It's not helpful, is it? And it can be just as distracting as other concepts. Grasping after concepts that seek to establish a self in an environment of emptiness or nothingness, or in an inherent Buddha nature or Buddhahood, is still grasping and is rooted in ignorance. The Buddha did not teach an empty nature of the phenomenal world, implying that nothing actually exists. He taught that nothing exists that should be used to establish or maintain a permanent or substantial ego self through clinging self-referential views to objects, events, views, and ideas, including clinging the self to the idea of some grand emptiness that I am aspiring to or that I am a part of. What are you laughing at? Just that incredibly long sentence?
Yeah, just about how you got round to, the facts. How it just all got round to...
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Even without the use of a period anywhere.
Yeah.
I still got there.
It's empty of periods.
Empty of short sentences. rather than attempt to establish a self in everything, clinging to impermanent objects, events, and ideas, or to crave for establishment of a self in discrete, impermanent phenomena or conceptual dharmas, both extreme views, the Buddha taught emptiness as a way of describing that followers of his Dhamma should be empty of clinging to objects, events, views, and ideas, and should not attach any notion of self into or onto the impermanent phenomenal world, including concepts of emptiness. Ultimately, emptiness refers to having a mind that is empty of any internal disturbance caused by self-referential clinging to objects, events, views, and ideas, including external identification with Buddhist practices that were never taught by the Buddha. So another way you could describe emptiness is how the Buddha described an awakened mind as a mind resting in equanimity. It's empty of any disturbance. Another proper application of emptiness. So again, we're not trying to develop any type of void. We're not trying to get to the point where we're empty of thoughts. That would be silly, wouldn't it? No useful application of that. Simply empty of disturbance rooted in ignorance. Going right back to the Four Noble Truths, going right back to dependent origination, going right back to the five clinging aggregates. Everything the Buddha taught was taught in the context of the Four Noble Truths and emptying ourselves of ignorance. Emptiness, as emptiness relates to the Buddha's teachings, is mostly a verb rather than a noun. It is skillful in this sense to see emptiness as such as emptying a glass of dirty water, rather than seeing emptiness as a grand cosmic environment to aspire to, or as the definition of an awakened self. The Buddha taught to empty oneself of craving and clinging, and to empty the world of self-referential clinging views. So again, using the contrast of emptiness as the goal, as the environment to attain to, I always had a problem with an understanding of nirvana or nibbana, and what that really means, what that's translated to, is to extinguish, meaning putting out the fires of passion. And that is described as an awakened human being, often in the same vein as describing emptiness as awakening, but emptiness as that grand cosmic void. Again, you can't reconcile the two. One is a conceptual place. One is an actual thing that we can accomplish. Putting out the fires of our own passion rooted in ignorance. That's nibbana or nirvana. That's the achievement of awakening. The Buddha, having awakened to dependent origination, taught an eightfold path to end ignorance and bring an end to craving for and clinging to all things interconnected with me. Now, isn't that what a self-referential deluded ego self does? It clings itself to everything. Everything is self-referential, even that oak tree that I talked about before. We see ourselves in the trees. We see ourselves in anything that occurs in our minds. So we are just the opposite of empty of clinging, aren't we? And when the Buddha describes an awakened human being, he describes him in just those terms, empty of clinging. So the first sutta, finally getting to the sutta. This is the Kulasanatta Sutta, the Lesser Discourse on Emptiness. The Buddha was at Savatthi in the Eastern Monastery, which happened to be a local palace, a rather luxurious place for the Buddha and his Sangha to find themselves, but they did spend time there. The Buddha's chief attendant and cousin Ananda, returning from seclusion, asked the Buddha, "On one occasion I heard you say, 'I now remain fully dwelling in the quality of mind in emptiness.' Did I hear this correctly? Did I learn this correctly? Did I remember this correctly?" The Buddha replied, remember Ananda was, the Buddha's chief attendant and cousin, I did read that. The Buddha replied, "Yes, Ananda, you heard that correctly, you learned it correctly, and you remembered it correctly. Now, as before, I remain fully dwelling in emptiness. Just as this place is empty of elephants and cattle and empty of gold or silver, empty of assemblies of women and men, there is only this non-emptiness of this community of monks. Even so, Ananda, when not distracted by the perception of the village, not distracted by the perception of a human being with self-referential views, there is only mindfulness of a wilderness with no distractions to what is not present." In other words, there is no discursive or speculative thought at that point. "The mind takes pleasure and finds satisfaction in being mindful of wilderness. The mind quiets and delights in the perception of wilderness." This is my commentary. Wilderness is metaphor for the pleasant abiding in samadhi, the non-distracted state. free of the distractions of craving for and clinging to the mundane objects of the village, meaning what the Buddha mentions, the elephants, the cattle, gold or silver, or the assemblies of men or women. The Buddha is describing being part of that world, but no longer distracted to it, not clinging to it, not clinging to gold or silver, or to having the biggest elephant or the most cattle, or to have the prettiest woman or the prettiest man, or being associated with any of those groups. And he talks about and specifically points to Ananda, accept the non-emptiness of the group of the Sangha. And that'll be, he addresses that in a beautiful way in just a few moments. So this is a subsection in the sutta, and the subtitle is called Emptiness of the Perception of the Village. The Buddha continues. It is then understood that whatever disturbances that would arise from being distracted by the things of the village are no longer present. He's teaching emptiness. The things that at one point he would have been distracted by, even though they're still there in the physical world, they're no longer present as a distraction in his mind. He's emptied himself of that clinging, so there's no longer distraction. Again, pointing right back to the emptiness of clinging views and emptiness of ignorance. He's no longer driven to clinging by ignorance of the way things really are. There is only the single-minded, well-concentrated samadhi, the single-minded focus based on the mindfulness of wilderness. It is understood that this perception is empty of the distraction of the things of the village, meaning your immediate surroundings. There is only this non-emptiness of the perception of wilderness. It is seen as being empty of what is not there, empty of disturbance by external self-identification. These are my words. Empty of disturbance by external self-identification, empty of ignorance. What is present is seen as there is only this. This is the entry into emptiness which is in accord with reality and is understood and pure. This, there is only this, is seeing things clearly with no self-referential views. My comments. The Buddha here is describing initial emptiness from the withdrawal of self-identifications with things of the local environment. The mind is calm and at peace, empty of disturbance arising from sensory stimulation rooted in wrong views. In other words, views that would lead you to connect yourself or create self-referential views about your environment. Now again, remember, the Buddha is completely immersed in the world. He's simply no longer distracted by his environment. He's empty of clinging, empty of wrong views. This relates directly to dependent origination. When this isn't, that isn't. When ignorance is abandoned, confused fabrications do not arise. The next subtitle, Emptiness of the Perception of Earth. Furthermore, Ananda, as concentration increases within the framework of the Eightfold Path, the perception of wilderness and of human beings falls away. Dispassionate mindfulness of the earth arises. What that means, dispassionate spaciousness of thinking arises. The mind takes pleasure. Excuse me. The mind takes pleasure and satisfaction in being mindful of the perception of earth. The mind quiets and delights. Excuse me. The mind quiets and delights in the perception of the earth. Just as a bull's hide is stretched free of wrinkles with many stakes, and that he's using that metaphor of mindfulness. Free of distraction to the ridges and hollows, the rivers and oceans, the trees and the stumps and brambles, the craggy irregularities of the earth, non-distraction based solely on the perception of the earth, free of discriminating thoughts, it is now understood that this perception is empty of a permanent human being, empty of the perception of a wilderness. Now there is only the non-emptiness of the perception of the earth. So all that whole thing about the brambles and the craggy, that's just... He's pointing out how we can create identities over the constantly changing and infinitely or nearly infinitely discrete aspects of the earth. We simply are present with what's occurring. There's nothing that needs to be any different. My commentary. Concentration has increased, but there continues a subtle self-identification to the earth. This is further entry into emptiness, which is in accord with reality and is undistorted and pure. The Buddha here is describing a non-self-referential view of the earth, meaning the mind is free of being distracted by the ever-changing qualities naturally inherent in the earth. And I'll relate this to something we talk about here a lot. In the Bahia Sutta, the Buddha teaches Bahia that in what is seen, there is only the seen. In what is heard, there is only the heard. In what is sensed, there is only the sensed. And in what is cognized, there is only the cognized. There's no self-referential views in that. You're just seeing things clearly without attaching yourself to something or needing something to be different than it is, meaning more of something or less than something, to take ownership of something. It's just here. The next subtitle, emptiness of the perception of the infinitude of space. So now we're getting into some more mystical teachings that the Buddha studied mastered these teachings and recognized that they are not leading to the goal. And this is interesting because this is where the modern application of emptiness, I think, arose from, even though the Buddha is saying don't. Furthermore, Ananda, as concentration increases within the framework of the Eightfold Path, the perception of wilderness and of human beings and of the earth falls away. This passionate mindfulness of the dimension of the infinitude of space arises. The mind takes pleasure and finds satisfaction in being mindful of the dimension of the infinitude of space. The mind quiets and delights in the perception of the dimension of the infinitude of space. My commentary. Notice that as local self-referential identification lessens, perceptual spaciousness increases. So our concentration is increasing, we're letting go of some views, and so we're not so attached to the local environment. Many of us describe that in our meditation practice as feeling that we're simply more spacious in our thoughts. The Buddha is describing that here. So we've gone from being attached to local things. We've progressed through being identified with a more spacious understanding, meaning noticing the earth in its entirety. And now the Buddha is taking us out in a very physical way, out into the cosmos, the infinitude of space, as a step in developing true understanding of emptiness and emptiness of clinging. It is, the Buddha's words, it is now understood that whatever disturbance that would arise based on the perception of wilderness or human beings or of the earth do not arise. The mind is empty of these perceptions. Again, he's speaking directly using the word empty. Empty of these perceptions. Empty of perceptions that are born in ignorance. There is only the non-emptiness of the perception of the dimension of the infinitude of space. The quality of mind is regarded as empty of what is not there. You recognize what you've done. You're developing it. And there's a significance to this. He's teaching Ananda that even if you have the understanding of the infinitude of space and you're able to dwell in that, you're not quite there, but you're on the way. You're expanding the spaciousness of your thinking. And he's using the infinitude of space and earth in a direct way, but also in a metaphorical way.
He says at that point you're still attached to that perception of infinity of space.
Yes, and thank you for bringing that up, because what he's teaching Ananda is you're attached to the context, the concept of it. Mm-hmm. So what mind seems, from a mind that started with being attached to gold and silver and cows and elephants, that you've made great progress, but you're not attached to that anymore, and you can dwell in this infinitude of space. And many people would say, that's great, I'm awakened, I'm there. And the Buddha say, no, you're not quite there yet, but you've made progress. And that's important to recognize that. My commentary. Concentration and non-clinging have brought deepening calm. The practitioner has not physically left the initial environment, but the mind is increasingly empty of disturbance. The next subtitle. Emptiness of the perception of the infinitude of consciousness. And so you'll be able to see where that idea of a grand cosmic consciousness came from. Furthermore, Ananda, as concentration increases within the framework of the Eightfold Path, the perception of wilderness and of human beings and of the earth and of the dimension of the infinitude of space falls away. This passionate mindfulness of the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness arises. And this is something that the Buddha studied also. One of his teachers was Udeka Ramaputta, who taught this, the perception of neither perception or non-perception, and the perception of nothingness and non-nothingness, which is something that Nagarjuna picked up 1,000 years later and became famous for that, and also the overriding belief that just because you're thinking of something, meaning now your consciousness used to believe that it was attached to the things of the village, then it believed in the Earth, then it expanded to include the entire cosmos. It's still consciousness rooted in ignorance. That's what the Buddha's talking about. Furthermore, Ananda, as concentration increases within the framework of the Eightfold Path, the perception of wilderness and of human beings and of the earth and of the dimension of the infinitude of space falls away. Dispassionate mindfulness of the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness arises. The mind takes pleasure and finds satisfaction in being mindful of the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness. The mind quiets and delights in the perception of the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness. Sounds like we're there, doesn't it? But the Buddha continues.
Can I ask something?
Sure.
That section starts with that there is dispassionate consciousness of the infinitude of...
Dispassionate mindfulness of the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness arises.
So it's dispassionate, but there's still a...
They're still clinging, and there's still some wrong view left there. One of the things that's important about this sutta and really all the Buddha teaches is that awakening is a gradual process. We even emptiness is something that is developed gradually for most people, unless you're Kandana and a few other folks. And again, using it in its proper context. So the Buddha is first showing Ananda, empty yourself of your clinging to the local environment, and your mind will naturally expand. And then empty it a little bit further from where it is, and continue to empty it of all these concepts that will naturally arise until you get to the point where we'll get to.
Yeah. I always thought that just the fact that you're no longer being passionate about it, it was enough that this is not clinging anymore.
No, this passion is part of the Eightfold Path that's developed that gets us to the point where we can finally let go of all views. I don't know if it's correct to describe it as an intermediate step, because it's really part of the entire Dhamma. And a fully awakened, fully mature human being rests in this passion also.
Right.
But along the way, we're creating... It's like...
The dispassion is a step in to non-clinging.
Yes, I use chocolate cake all the time, so I'll continue to use it. All my life I've been passionate about chocolate cake, and I can't get enough of the chocolate cake. As I start developing a well-concentrated mind and recognizing my attachments to things, using chocolate cake as an example, as I become dispassionate about chocolate cake, my clinging towards chocolate cake it diminishes. Mm-hmm. But I'm still clinging to other things. Like a nice fresh apple pie. It's a gradual process that we're talking about here for most people. Again, we can move through it. Some people move through it quicker than others. There's nothing that says that it has to take many, many, many years. But the Buddha is describing the process of emptying here. Where was it? Let me go back. Lost my place. The quality of mind, let me go back one more sentence. The mind is empty of these perceptions. There is only the non-emptiness of the perception of the dimension of infinitude of consciousness. Everybody got that?
That's a bit wordy for me.
There is only the non-emptiness of the perception of the dimension of the infinitude. He's just saying that you're still attached to that. The quality of mind is regarded as empty of what is not there. This is further entry into emptiness, which is in accord with reality and is undistorted and pure, my commentary. As increasing local self-referential identification lessens, perceptual spaciousness increases. Next subtitle. Emptiness of the perception of the dimension of nothingness. Furthermore, Ananda, as concentration increases within the framework of the Eightfold Path, the perception of wilderness and of human beings and of earth and of the dimension of the infinitude of space and of the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness falls away. Dispassionate mindfulness of the dimension of nothingness arises. So you find yourself in this dimension of nothingness. You're dispassionate about it, but yet you have not let go of all of the views related to that. The mind takes pleasure and finds satisfaction in being mindful of the dimension of nothingness. The mind quiets and delights in the perception of the dimension of nothingness. It is now understood that whatever disturbances that would arise based on the perception of wilderness or human beings, or of the earth, or the dimension of the infinitude of space, or of the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness do not arise. The mind is empty of these perceptions. Remember where perceptions is. Perceptions follows fabrications, which follows ignorance. So he's pointing all of this back. Even these now this grand view of the cosmos is still rooted in ignorance. I mean, that's really an important point to make, because there's great pleasure when you find yourself, at least for many people, myself, and I'll use myself as an example, when you can find your consciousness rooted in this grand spaciousness of the cosmos. And I won't get into some stories. I can tell you some pretty incredible stories where I found myself in this state. It feels like this has got to be it, because this is amazing. And all it is a distraction and an illusory mind state.
And isn't that another self-referential?
Exactly. Yes. That and now I'll talk about myself. I can think. I'm thinking of, phew, I'm so caught up in it. I'm thinking of an occurrence that happened to me in Hawaii during a guided meditation. I had a teacher who was very well versed in NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. She could really get you going wherever she wanted to get you going. And she got me going into this incredible space that I've never been to before, that at the time I was completely attached to. And I spent a long time after that, this was on a retreat called, I spent a lot of time trying to recreate that. And having that self-referential view, I've really awakened. I used to consider myself this grand cosmic being while I was walking around bumping into trees and telephone poles. You know? I created this strong identity, and many, many people, and that's the subtle draw of a misunderstanding of emptiness. I can find myself or place myself in this empty void, and now I'm not responsible for anything that occurs anymore, am I? Especially if I'm sitting here waiting for my inner Buddha nature to arise.
And all that work for something that you can get to by a nice hit of LSD.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe that's why I was so enamored with it. I lost my spot, so I'm just going to go back. Excuse me if I'm... I'll go back to the beginning, because I forgot where I'm going. There is only the non-emptiness of the...
Many words to describe emptiness.
It's a tough one. There is only the non-emptiness of the perception of the dimension of emptiness. The quality of mind is regarded as empty of what is not there. This is further entry into emptiness, which is in accord with reality and is undistorted and pure. My commentary. Non-emptiness of the perception of the dimension of nothingness refers to the quality of mind of knowing that it is empty of disturbance. Nothingness refers to a quality of mind that is free of self-referential views that would otherwise cause disturbance, meaning how the Buddha's using nothingness. Emptiness of the perception of the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. Furthermore, Ananda, as concentration increases within the framework of the Eightfold Path, the perception of wilderness and of human beings and of the earth and of the dimension of the infinitude of space and the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness and of the dimension of nothingness falls away. Dispassionate mindfulness of the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception arises. The mind takes pleasure and finds satisfaction in being mindful of the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. The mind quiets and delights in the perception of the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. There's a great school of Buddhism, mostly attributed to Nagarjuna, that based everything on that, what the Buddha is saying is an intermediate step. It is now understood that whatever disturbances that would arise based on the perception of wilderness or human beings or of the earth or the dimension of the infinitude of space or the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness or of the dimension of nothingness do not arise. The mind is empty of these perceptions. There is only the non-emptiness of the perception of the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. See how hard it is to awaken?
You know, you can tell us about this part.
Well,
We should stop now. I'm almost done.
Right? And, you know, it,
no wonder why people don't want to empty themselves.
You keep dumping it out. So you
keep on doing it.
You can really see how silly it is to create a Buddhist practice about trying to achieve this empty state that reconciles all this silliness into it. And the Buddha is just referring to things that were common at that time. They were the major based in the Vedas, and are still common today. It is silly to make a practice over these things and to overemphasize something that shouldn't be overemphasized. And we're almost done. My commentary. The quality of mind is regarded as empty of what is not there. Concentration and refined mindfulness have developed to the point where recognition of equanimity is realized. The dimensions of fabricated mind states of nothingness and of neither perception nor non-perception were studied by the Buddha from his early teachers Alarakalama and Udeka Ramaputta. Their teachings were from the Vedas, which modern Hinduism is based on. The Buddha rejected these teachings as this Dhamma leads not to disenchantment or to dispassion or to cessation or to stilling or to direct knowledge or even to awakening or to unbinding, but only to reappearance in the dimension of nothingness, meaning that you've created this space of nothingness, just like we said, you created identity of it. That's where you're going to be. You're creating yourself a reappearance in this dimension that has no basis in reality, doesn't in truth exist, but yet you'll find yourself there. And once you've done that, if you've spent years practicing to develop that idea of nothingness, it's very hard to turn that around. You've got a very conditioned mind towards that. He said that in regard to Alarakalama's teachings. And then in regards to Udeka Ramaputta, this Dhamma leads not to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to stilling, to direct knowledge, to awakening, nor to unbinding, but only to reappearance in the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. Who wants to go there? The Mahayana schools of Buddhism has adapted these teachings rejected by the Buddha to support the view of emptiness as an environment to establish the self in, rather than recognizing that the striving for realizing these dimensions is a subtle doctrine of eye-making. And it's really good that Helen and Kevin, you picked up right on it. It's just all eye-making. That's all it is. So I guess I could have saved a lot of talk and repetition by saying
I took a picture of that reading it. There's one place in the article I saw that. It said it's another place for
eye-making. It's just more eye-making. So, let me finish it. Release from all fabricated views. Finally, Ananda, having abandoned the perceptions of the dimensions of nothingness and of the perception of the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception, one abides in single-minded concentration, free of self-referential views. The translation that I've applied to words self-referential views is usually translated as awareness release, meaning we have the awareness of the release from clinging. Awareness, release, or free of self-referential views. The quality of mind is regarded as empty of what is not there. There is a satisfied and pleasant abiding. Satisfies as opposed to unsatisfactory, meaning dukkha. There is a satisfied and pleasant abiding. The mind quiets and is gratified in single-minded concentration, the reason why we meditate. Free of self-referential views. The Buddha continues. It is understood that this single-minded concentration, free of self-reference, is fabricated and formed through thought. Having abandoned all self-referential views, it is understood that whatever is fabricated and formed through thought is impermanent and subject to cessation. Understanding the impermanent nature of all fabrications, the mind is released from the stress of sensuality, from the stress of becoming or more eye-making, and from the stress of ignorance. It is understood that birth of further ignorant views has ended, the integrated life has been lived, meaning integrated with the Eightfold Path. The path is complete, there is nothing left clinging to the world. It is further understood that whatever disturbances that arose from the stress of sensuality, from the stress of becoming or eye-making, and from the stress of ignorance are no longer present. You've emptied yourselves of them. There is now only the minor disturbance connected with a sense base that is dependent on the body, with life as the condition of disturbance. There is only the non-emptiness connected with a sixth sense base and dependent on this body with life as the condition. What is not present is understood as empty of what is not present. Whatever remains is understood as what is present. And what is seen, there is only the seen. And what is heard, there is only the heard. And what is cognized, there is only what is cognized. So Ananda, this final entry into emptiness, which is in accord with reality and is undistorted and pure. Ananda, whoever enters and remains in this emptiness, whether past, present, or future, they all enter into the same emptiness that is undistorted and pure, superior and unsurpassed. Therefore, Ananda, train yourself to enter in the same emptiness that is undistorted and pure, superior and unsurpassed. This is what the Buddha said, and Ananda was delighted in those words. That's the end of the Kula Sanatha Sutta.
And that was the short sutta.
Actually, the Mahasanatha Sutta, the greater discourse, is shorter than the lesser discourse. So I bet you're glad we're through that, aren't you?
Yeah. I can't wait for the retreat.
Well, all of these discourses will be given. There'll be two short discourses on Sunday. Maybe that's why I'm getting through them this week. Thursday we'll do the Mahasanatha Sutta, which touches on the same subject but in a slightly different way.
How different? I just want to know, maybe I'll get it.
Well, so...
I mean, I get it, but, you know, he talks almost in riddles sometimes. It's the perception and the non-perception. It's like, there's, I don't know.
Mind bomb.
Yeah, thank you.
So you should appreciate my simplification of the sutta. You want to go read the sutta, because it's even more repetitive of that. But I agree with you.
Redundancy, which kind of swirls my mind.
It swirls anybody's.
I get going where it's going, and then they hit you with, well, it's not that. Okay, but I wasn't going that way. Yeah, so
it's like, what?
Yeah, I wish it would just...
Wait, what? What did you say? You're going to learn how to not be ignorant.
Yeah, there's a little... the redundancy is distracting to me.
It's distracting to me. I think it's distracting to everyone. If you remember, getting slightly off topic, and then I'll get back to emptiness. If you remember how the Buddha's Dhamma was preserved, it was preserved as an oral tradition through repetitive chanting. And so when it came to be written down, they just carried that through.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
And, if you read the actual sutta, the translation, it's twice as long and twice as repetitive of this. So I simplified it as much as I could, hoping to maintain what the Buddha was talking about. But the perception, non-perception, nothingness, non-nothingness, those are all related to common spiritual teachings of his time that are nearly as prevalent, maybe as prevalent today, just in different words. In other words, the modern application of the word emptiness includes all those ideas of perception, non-perception, nothingness, non-nothing, all of that. And if you remember when I talk about Vajragoda and a few other folks who ask these grand mystical questions, is the universe finite or infinite, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They're talking about that same thing. Because for at least 2,600 years, that's been a common go-to place for people seeking an awakened state of mind, that there must be something more cosmic about it. And the Buddha, when he awakened, again, he had studied these teachings that were confusing to him and realizing not leading to the goal. He said, it's none of that. It's much simpler than this, than what you've been taught. Here it is. It's ignorance of the reality of your day-to-day life. That's the problem. Get your head out of the clouds. Stop worrying about these grand questions.
Right.
Come, put your. I'm sorry. Bring your thinking and your activities where they are, down to earth. Be concerned with what's occurring in this moment. Be concerned with what is actually causing disturbance in your mind. And in order to do that, you have to develop concentration so you can see what's there. And you'll also recognize that these conceptual applications are just a waste of time. They're another aspect. You hit it right on the head, Helen and Kevin. They're all aspects of eye-making, which is...
And even being concerned, isn't that self-referential?
In most cases, it certainly is. And so when you think about establishing myself in another realm as somehow awakening, when you haven't figured out this realm yet, it's just escapism.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the
or maybe the other realm makes more sense.
Well, you hope that it's more pleasant, that if you can find yourself in some higher mystical realm, that but you've missed your life then if you've done that. I think I've recounted this story a few times, that I got a call. This is going back a couple of years now. I don't want to, please hold on to what you were saying. I got a call from a guy in Newtown. And it was 38 years old. I could hear the agitation in his voice. He said, I'm 38 years old. I'm living the American dream. I got a beautiful house, two or three cars, the great family, all this. And I've been meditating for 20 years, and I feel like I got nothing in my life. And as soon as he said that, I had an inclination about where it was going. I said, well, tell me about your meditation practice. He says, well, I use a certain practice that I won't name. People will be able to figure it out. And he says, my practice is basically I sit down and I focus on nothingness. And I said, would you say that again? He says, I sit down and I focus on nothingness, which is what a major school of Buddhism is focused on. And I could almost hear the light bulb going off in his mind. And he said, holy, for 20 years I've been focusing on nothingness, and that's what I have. Mm-hmm. He established himself in the realm of nothingness. And he could not see the wonderful life that he's living. He couldn't even have appreciation for the life that he had. He felt like he had nothing. That's what the Buddha's talking about. And I agree with you. It's very discursive type of rhetoric, but it gets to the heart of the matter.
And when you give anecdotal stories, that it helps to make sense, helps to put it into context.
Yeah, well, even talking about that experience I had in Hawaii, and I had a lot of those experiences in my early meditation career because I was focused on generating experiences in my mind, and every time I had one, I thought it was real, and I overlooked the fact that this is just something self-created. But, you know, and you can say that that was valuable in getting to the point where I know what it's not, and some people have even said that to me. They've read my bio and said, well, it got, you know. Maybe that's true, but I also feel like I wish I didn't have to waste all that time and doing all those other things, and somebody had said, you know, there's all these other practices, they're wonderful, and then there's a guy that taught you how to live in the world day to day in a very peaceful and happy way. What do you want? Well, I said, I'm going
to
go after that.
I wanted to ask is that in this whole, to me, long discourse, is he describing necessary steps and levels of the movement to Nirvana, or is this just like, well, don't go there, just go right here?
Yeah, it's more like the last. He's explaining to Ananda the pitfalls of getting caught up in all these different things.
Because it's easy to see it in such a way. I mean, when I first read that sutta a year or two ago, I thought, oh my God, you got to go through this, then I have to go through that, and then I have to go through that. Oh, Jesus Christ. You know, we'll never get there.
Yeah, so remember what the sutta is on, emptiness of views, of mm-hmm. ignorant views. Mm-hmm. All you have to do is develop wisdom where there was once ignorance. You don't have to go to these places.
That's better, though.
But he's also describing the pitfalls of not following an Eightfold Path mm-hmm. and engaging in any type of meditative, this is more applicable to today, but even true then, any meditative practice, because the mind naturally wants to go to these places and look where they went. Now, all these different dimensions were an accepted spiritual practice. This was taught as the highest spiritual understanding, something that you should aspire to. You should understand all these different dimensions. And again, the Buddha mastered these. Both of those teachers that I mentioned wanted the Buddha to come with them and be their main representative. And he said, your Dhamma just doesn't do it for me. It's not what I'm after. And he didn't say that they're completely useless. He's never said any of that, and I'm not saying that. I'm saying if you want to develop an understanding of how to live in the world moment by moment in deep mindfulness and peace, that's what the Buddha taught. We don't have to go into those other places.
He precedes every part with somebody rooted in the Eightfold Path.
Yeah. Again, in the Eightfold Path, if you actually integrate the Eightfold Path, you'll avoid getting stuck in these different dimensions. You'll avoid further eye-making in any way. You know, including eye-making as the world's most perfect Buddhist practitioner. There's none of that. You're just seeing what's here. And if you find yourself, if you develop a deep enough level of concentration, you'll recognize when you're even using your own Buddhist practice as eye-making. Because you'll see the silliness in it. Why would I create another type of label over what I'm doing? The Buddha never called his Sangha anything. He never gave it any kind of name. He never called himself a Buddha or an awakened one. You know, he never changed anything. They learned how to live their lives in peace and equanimity, empty of ignorance. Lorna, did you have a question before we go around the room?
Realms of cosmos and things. I mean, I don't think the realms of cosmos and things. I mean, I never go there anyway. But you just said that's what they were teaching in those days and all that sort of stuff. So I just how he addressed that problem of the day.
Yeah.
But
oh, and many people, you're very fortunate
about it.
Yeah. You have a much more real. You're starting from a much more realistic view. You're lucky. But many people don't, even today, you know, and they're, you know, I don't want to keep beating them up, but most of the later developed schools treat emptiness in the way that the Buddha said don't, you know, in one way or another. What's important is to see, is to understand that what we're doing here in Dhamma practice is emptying ourselves of ignorance, you know, the dependent origination. When we do that, when we empty ourselves of ignorant views, maybe the useful thing about this, the most useful thing about this sutta, is that it does take us through the progression of letting go of views and finally getting to that place of living in reality. You know, and using these discursive and confusing words is just, it's just the way that the Buddha described it because that was common practice. But again, it's rather common today. You know, especially that idea, the idea of nothingness and an inner Buddha nature. And the idea of a cosmic type of emptiness that we're all a part of, those are all extreme views, but they're common modern views too. So, any other questions on the sutta, and then we'll go around. Joe?
It was, and I guess I could be completely wrong, but probably am. Is this the point where he needed to address the metaphysical for just in order for it to be complete?
Well, yes, I mean, he does this in a few different ways, but yeah, it was common back then too. You know, there. My interest in Eastern philosophy was piqued when I was 19 years old. I was actually in a drug rehab of all places, and my sister gave me two books. She brought and thought it'd be a good reading. One was Siddhartha, the novel by Hermann Hesse, and the other was Think on These Things by Krishnamurti, and that got my mind thinking about other things. I didn't quit drinking or drugging for a few more years, so they weren't very productive. And then I saw a movie, I can't think of the name of it. It's about Shangri-La, but I can't think of the name of the movie. You knew what I was talking about.
Yeah.
Do you remember the name of the movie?
No, I don't, but it's you know, where they,
It's about
they find themselves in this place through a plane crash or something.
Yeah, a military guy crashed in the Himalayas. I don't even know if they mention it's in the Himalayas, but
6, 7 years in Tibet.
No, way before that. It was like
this is like 1960s.
Oh, earlier. I think it was in the 40s.
It's a very strange movie.
So he lands. He lands in the Himalayas. He finds himself into this place called Shangri-La, this paradise on heaven, where he finds out that some of the teachers live for hundreds and hundreds of years. Everybody lives in bliss. I'll make a long story short. It's portrayed in mystical ways too. That if you had the right to remember the little old teacher, I used to remember his name even, and if you followed this philosophy, you'll gain this magical knowledge and you'll live forever and you'll. And that's what I wanted. And that was my desire and my goal to develop a quality of mind. And then I got into other teachings. You know, I fell into, I shouldn't mention his name, but I fell into some Hindu-based teachings that you can develop the ability to bilocate and travel the cosmos in your body and fly around. This all sounded great, and that's what I chased for quite a few years. I didn't realize that the only reason it sounded so great is I wanted an escape from my miserable life. Mm-hmm. And that really was what it was. Even if you could do that, even if I could right now fly to the moon or something, why would I want? Here's where I am. This is where I want to be. But I didn't understand that. There was a lot of eye-making involved in all of those practices, starting back to probably the first time I read those books. And it wasn't until I came to the Buddha's direct teachings and read things like this that I realized the fruitlessness of my search. It might be fun, it might be entertaining, it's certainly a great distraction. But it doesn't teach me how to live today, which is really what I want, and it's what all human beings want. How do I have the most meaningful and fruitful life that I can possibly have? Develop the Dhamma and awaken. Somebody's really late to class. Hello.
Do you mind if I join?
Please. We're kind of just finishing up a talk. I'm John.
I'm Isaiah.
Isaiah, it's nice to meet you. We're just finishing up a talk on emptiness. But since you're here, I'll go back and read it. I'm sorry, Isaiah. You're falling into a joke that you have no reference for. I just gave a talk on something called the Kulasanatta Sutta, a sutta on Buddha's teachings on emptiness, and it was rather long and involved. And I think we're all glad it's over. we're going to go around the room and discuss our meditation practice now, and then we'll talk in a little bit. So, Ram, how you doing? What are you empty of?
Find out.
Please, it's okay to come Thursday night to listen to the Maha, but
if it's short, I'll buy me.
It is.
This is good. The beginning of the talk was a bit more confusing than the end was okay. I was starting to get the hang of it. And I'm starting to see how all those, you know, chasing after these strange mind states, it's still a distraction.
Yeah.
It pops up every now and then. I realize that I'm downplaying my meditation because I'm not getting to those states.
Yeah.
And this is another good reminder that that's not what it's about.
Yeah.
We're going to work on that.
Yeah, thank you. It's so easy to fall into pleasant mind states during meditation and think that's the point. I've arrived. I've done it. When it's just a distraction. That's why I always say over and over again, meditation is...
No, for me, it's deep... more the disappointment that I'm not going to have pleasant mind states.
Yeah. Again, it's not... I mean, and that's okay, too. It's okay to enjoy those situations. But remember that meditation is for deepening concentration, not for developing experiences, certainly self-referential ones. Good to see you, Kevin.
Good to see you, John. Really appreciate this talk.
You do?
I like it, you know. I mean, I think while it is very, you know, lengthy and verbose, I mean, I understand, I think, why the Buddha is repeating all this and why he's trying to take you as far away as you want to go. You can go to the other end of the galaxy, the cosmos, the emptiness. Every single answer points you right back here.
Yep.
To your moment-by-moment life. And I understand why people, you know, this isn't, like you say, it's not for everybody. I mean, this feels like you're annihilating what you've, you know, come to, yeah, to understand as yourself, but... Sorry, that's not it. You know, it's not the answer. You know, it's like you're looking at a funhouse group of mirrors, and well, that one can't be it. The one right in front of me—that's definitely not it. Yeah. I know more than that. It's too simple. You know, I got to look over here. Nope, break that one. Break that one. Break them all down.
Yeah.
It's right here. So, it's getting there. I'm looking forward to the retreat and the other retreat. Thank you for cutting that in half.
Yeah, thank you. You got me thinking of the funhouse mirrors. I always liked the mirror that made me look 6'6". Helen, good to see you tonight.
Thank you, John. Good to be here. I like what Kevin said. Perhaps it was the simplicity of how he broke it down further. But it sort of reminds me of some of the sayings of Lao Tzu and how seeing is not seeing, and just, you know, the yin and the yang, using the opposing words to explain something.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I will try to revisit that and see if there's, you know, I was trying to find the main path as, you know, all of these other jug handles were being applied, but I think I understand the main thread. And I'm going to try not to be distracted by all the side turns.
Yeah, good. Thank you. The talk on Thursday doesn't get quite as involved, and the Saturday talk on emptiness from the Kakaya Yanagata Sutta, doesn't get into any of this, and it relates it directly, relates emptiness directly to not self and dependent origination. So that's a little bit more easily understood. And I think next week I'll give a talk on the Panha Sutta, which the Buddha directly relates, and again, not in conceptual terms, emptiness to the five clinging aggregates. So to empty yourself of those misunderstandings. Again, just how the Buddha presented it. So I think you'll find those a little bit easier to grasp. I'm glad you're here tonight. Diane, how are you tonight?
I'm here.
Glad you're here.
I kind of I was going to say I spaced out for some of this. what I experienced this week was one of the clients that I have just really pushes my buttons, and I can get so angry and she's just, I mean, like, I just want to say, you're going the wrong way. I mean, just stop it. Turn around. Listen to me. Do what I say. And then when I get there, I think, that's not it at all. And what I'm finding is that I'm seeing myself reflected in most of my clients. And then I don't like that. And then I think, oh. And then I realize that that's a past me, or a future me, or some, it's not me, really. But it takes me, I'm still ignorant, I guess, because, I mean, in this aspect, it takes me a while to get there and realize that kind of doesn't make any difference. It just let him be, you know, keep going back to that Mother Mary, let it be. Let it be. Let him be where he is, doing what he's doing, and I'm just to listen to what he's doing. And that's what I think meditation is for me, is it's my time. And it's, and it becomes a time where I can be empty, not anything, and that's so relaxing and restful. I don't know if I'm making any sense. I'm not really talking to this sutra at all, but. I guess, to tell you the truth, John, I feel a little confused in that I get the I-making part of it. And I get that, there's almost the inclination that I'm nothing, but then I feel like I'm a part of something, and that's, I heard that referred to in there about, you know, part of the cosmos, you know, Earth and all that kind of stuff, the elements that we're all made up of. And it just, I guess that where I go in that is, it feels really confusing, and so I'm just content to be here, period. I don't have to do anything or spectacular or be anything spectacular or tell somebody else how they should or shouldn't be. I hate that myself, so it's just, maybe this whole thing boiled down in a nutshell for me is just be gentle. That's good enough. I don't know. I don't know. feel profound tonight. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm glad you're here. It's very skillful that you recognize when you're eye making. I mean, that really is the point. But sometimes it feels like annihilation too. But it's not. You know, annihilation is another extreme view that doesn't come into play. Bonnie, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you and everybody. So I listen, I think I get it. And I was like, what? I like lose my way. Because I'm so usually listen better when I'm doing something visual. But ultimately, what you said before you read this sutta was really helpful. I can't remember exactly how you said it, but essentially that understanding emptiness is about learning how to, I said it before, but for me in my head to understand that, it's understanding the ignorance of the situation and learning to see objectively in a non-judgmental way.
Yeah.
So then when you were talking about that, like really, because his teachings weren't written down for a very long time, and what better way to remember but to put it into a song or chant. So that makes a lot more sense. So next week you'll bring the sheet music? No, I'm kidding. But because there are, you know, some places, I'm not saying that we should do that or I want to do that, but it makes sense then that some of it was the way of bringing it then to someplace else and being able to remember and remind ourselves. Yeah. But so that was interesting in terms of understanding why it has to be written like that, other than, I'm sure there are a lot of other lessons, of course there are, but for me, always if I can simplify it, which brings it down, and it, you know, about the idea of emptiness and the, you know, that's rooted in the stuff that's rooted in ignorance that keeps us from it, from the truth, from seeing the space. And so for me, somebody told me the reason why things are happening like this is because there are all these solar flares and there's comet going by, and I was like, well, I don't know, but I wasn't meditating as much this week, and I could really feel it. And so when being able to then make the time to sit, it really helps me to be more even keeled when there's I have a lot of stressors right now related to, you know, some of my work. And it is going to be there. So it's really nice to, like, even, like, I think in the past I would have felt, like, miserable about the state of the pile on. Whereas, so I can feel myself getting towards that place, but because of the spaciousness that this really provides, even like when you think about that, like Diane was saying about sitting and what the meditation provides, so that I can be less ignorant, that of course, you know, this happens all the time, and you don't have to react to the same way. So it's really, I can see how because for me, I always understand the thoughtfulness, the mindfulness aspect, the Eightfold Path, which I adore, but to really understand it related to the dukkha, that it just, but it's always going to be that way, and I have a choice.
Yeah.
And the spaciousness gives you that space to breathe.
Yep. Thank you. You bring up something that's really significant, the solar flares and the comets that are affecting the way that people are on the earth. Maybe that's true, but that's all part of dukkha. And if we have a well-concentrated mind that has supporting the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, won't have any effect on us because we're not identified with it. It doesn't matter.
I don't have to react to it the way I...
Yeah, and there is something to that. There's something... Ask a commercial fisherman if the moon affects tides.
Mm-hmm.
Sure it does. But you can't take it personal. If you do, then you're in trouble.
So
you know, there's something to all of that.
Book about that.
But the point about the Dhamma is to recognize that's all part of dukkha occurring. It's just part of the phenomenal world. Peace and happiness prevails when we don't need it to be any different. In other words, we don't need the moon to stop acting on the tides, you know, because I got to go out and fish tonight. It's just the way it is. Don't take it personally.
Or not be upset if you only get one fish.
Yeah.
Or no fish.
I don't think I ever caught more than one at a time anyway. Thank you.
I never fished.
Liz, good to see you. Frankie.
I just want to say good night. I have to go. My wife is leaving for Italy tomorrow.
Tell Dawn I said have a great trip. I'm glad you made it tonight, my friend.
Good seeing everybody.
See you, Frank.
See you, Frank.
I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah.
Liz, good to see you today.
Good to see you too. I don't really have that much except that I was in the bus. I was on the ride. You got to a certain point, and I really thought that a whole other gate had opened into what. Of an expectation of where I was supposed to take this. And I just thought it just kind of blew me away a little. Realizing that what he was talking about was what not to be distracted by, I can understand that. And I feel like I'm back on the bus and the bus is pulling into the station and I'm in a good place. So that's the ride I went on tonight.
I'm glad you came for the ride. If you remember how the sutta unfolded, Ananda asked the Buddha a question, what's emptiness? What's your experience of it? And the Buddha described how he came to his understanding by going through all those ridiculous dimensions and concepts to coming back to what's occurring right here, right now.
Yeah, I think we all at some point might stick our toe in the waters of some kind of mystical expectation or experience. And what I found with this study is that it's such a relief to know that that's not part of the pursuit.
Yeah, to me too, yeah. It's entirely practical. Thanks, Liz. Joe, good to see you again.
Well, it's good to be back. I don't even know what to say. just coming back into the United States after about 10 weeks out, speaking a different language, trying to motivate a team of people that in the 10 months that I left them alone hated each other, I realized that it's really difficult to maintain a meditation practice without the Sangha, especially when I was dealing with a lot of resentment with other people that I had to live with it, and I became very resentful, and my meditation came to an end at that point. And it wasn't until I got back home and I read the flyer that you have out there, the yellow one that's like 8x10 or 8x6, and it's addressed at the very end about the four things that will hurt your meditation practice, one of them being resentment.
Yeah.
Boy, that's true. So, just because I'm just back, I'm seeking relevance, I guess, but on so many different levels. So it's just good to be back. As far as the talk goes, it was pretty crazy to jump back in right here at this point. Back when I cared about how well I played the guitar, like going back to when I was a kid, like sitting down with like an Eddie Van Halen guitar solo, it's like, okay, I'm going to learn this. And then realizing that, okay, I have to develop a lot of technique to do this that I may or may not have, whatever. But most importantly, this is going to be an impossible task unless I'm able to listen to it enough so that I hear every individual note. Mm-hmm. Without hearing every individual note, there's just no way I can play this. That's kind of how I took the talk.
It's
a great.
Yeah, it's the sutta is not empty of a need for intense focus.
Yeah.
But it all gets back to emptying yourself of clinging views and ignorant views. You know that's what the Buddha's addressing there. So I'm glad you're back with us tonight. So, Isaiah, I'll get to you in just a moment, but I want to hear what Lorna has to say.
I've spoken already about the sutta, but it was very wordy for me, and I was just lost in the words. but I get the main theme of it. Maybe I am blessed that I don't think on that great cosmic scale anyway. You know, I just live in it. I'm looking for things in day to day. One thing that just did resonate was you said that only is what is seen is seen. Only is what is heard, only is what is cognized, decognized, and I think that's what it was in a way. That if you could have just such a simple mind that didn't react to things you see, things you hear, you know, if you could just keep it to what you see, what you hear, what you cognize, but, and not have a reaction mind that just goes ping, 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 you know, and makes up all these scenarios about what you see, what you hear, what you... I thought, what a delightful place, what a delightful mind that must be. And when things like that, when you have a realization of you can possibly have that kind of quietness in your mind, that's what keeps me coming to class. That simple thought of not having all the clutter and all the thoughts and all the stuff that we've preferential thoughts and views. And, you know, I just wish I could have that mind, that simple mind. So I keep on coming for that. But I don't come for all the cosmic stuff.
And you've had experience of that quiet, peaceful mind. I know you have.
I'm very happy today.
And if you, this talk itself included some crazy elements, but really the sutta was about avoid these crazy elements.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not part of practice. Mm-hmm. There's something to be recognized as distraction. The Buddha concludes this with just getting back to telling Ananda, it's about your practice within the Eightfold Path.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's most important. Isaiah, welcome to our Sangha. Our typical class starts with a meditation, 20 minutes on Tuesdays and Thursdays and 30 on Saturday. Then I give a talk and we have a discussion like this. So I hope you'll join us from the beginning of a class one of these nights. Do you have a meditation practice now?
It's broken.
Okay, well, we can fix it. There's a class here Tuesday night, 7:15, Thursday, 7:15, and Saturday at 8:30 in the morning. There's a booklet outside, a yellow booklet that describes the meditation method that we use here. Please take it, and you can read that. On my website, there is a guided Shamatha Vipassana meditation that you can download and listen to. And then come to class. And what I teach here is meditation within the broader framework of the Eightfold Path. It's not just meditation. I hope you come back. We're going to do a quick meditation called Metta Meditation. We close our classes with that, and I'll guide you all through it. So, and just a couple of quick announcements. I am starting a Thursday night class this week. Our one-day retreat is Sunday. There's info on the website, and our residential retreat is coming up in May 11th to 14th. So, the theme of this both retreats is emptiness, but I won't be reading this sutta at either one of them. All right, so find your relaxed meditative posture.
Well, maybe just like every third word.
Yeah, there'll be nothing difficult.
Furthermore.
Okay, so find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And metta is both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an expression of an awakened, fully mature human being. And these are the words of the Buddha from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is no longer born into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.